Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Did you have an opportunity to attend the session with Justice Rogensack at noon? Yes or no? No. Okay, I'm sorry, but if you have time after this session, we might be able to give you a few moments to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues we are about to hear in this case. The students are here with a court with class, it's the name of our program, in which we invite high school students from around the state to come and listen to an oral argument. And if they agree to come, they're given materials about the case, and they may engage in some outside activities relating to this case. They come to court, they listen to oral argument, and if they can, they are here at noon for a discussion about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues. If anyone would like a copy of a summary about the case, we'd be happy to give you one if you raise your hand. Would anyone like a copy? All right. If you change your mind, raise your hand, and the deputy marshal will give you a copy. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. She is seated next to Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. To his left is Justice Patience Rogensack, and to the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With all of our introductions made, I will now call our third case for today, 07AP1396, Kelly Harvick versus Solo Cup Company. Representing Kelly Harvick is Peter J. Culp. Counsel, you may proceed.
Justice Abramson, members of the court, good afternoon. As the Chief Justice mentioned, my name is Peter Culp. I represent the appellant, Kelly Harvick, in this case, who is also present here in the room. The case is before this court on certification from the Court of Appeals. The two issues or questions that were certified to this court are, number one, whether there's an implied right to a jury trial in a civil damages action under the Wisconsin Family and Medical Leave Act. The second issue or question that has been certified to this court is whether or not there's a constitutional right to a jury trial in a civil damages action under the Wisconsin Family and Medical Leave Act. If this court decides the first issue in the affirmative, meaning that there is an implied right, then we do not get to the second question as to whether there's a constitutional right. And we know that based on the case of Labor and Farm Party, Tull, and Delaware and Hudson, which says that cases really should be decided on non-constitutional grounds, if at all possible. Turning to the first issue of an implied right, I must begin by noting that in the Butzloff case, that's 223 with second at 689, the courts have talked about construing the Family and Medical Leave Act in a liberal manner. Starting from that and keeping that in mind, the key issue from our perspective with respect to whether there's an implied jury trial right has to do with the enforcement mechanism under section 103.10(13)(a).
Counsel, when you say liberal manner, liberal as to what?
Liberal as to serving the purposes underlying the Wisconsin Family and Medical Leave Act, which encompasses both the substantive rights as well as the procedural rights from our perspective. In evaluating the enforcement mechanism of the Wisconsin Family and Medical Leave Act, it is extremely critical and important to consider As part of the statutory construction, the sister employment regulations that can be found near the FMLA. The first is the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, which is codified at 111.31 in the following statutes, as well as the Wisconsin Workers' Compensation Act. Now, why do I say that it's critical to look at those statutes? It's critical because there's a similarity, at least at one level, with respect to all three acts. The similarity is that the case begins with the filing of an administrative complaint before the Department of Workforce Development. Once that case is concluded, that's where the FMLA diverges from the other two. It diverges because if you appeal a decision from the Department of Workforce Development under either the Workers' Compensation Act or the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, you actually go to the Labor and Industry Review Commission. Then you go to Circuit Court under the Administrative Procedures Act. That is not the case with the FMLA. What happens in the FMLA is once you prevail at the administrative level, you can file an action in the Circuit Court and seek legal damages, money damages, supplementary remedies that cannot be awarded in the administrative by the administrative tribunal. When we look at the difference in that enforcement mechanism, there must be a reason why the legislature did that. The best that we were able to come up with is when we look at the work decisions of Getch, 1991 decision. We look at the subsequent amendment to the Open Housing Act, which Getch was dealing with. And then we look at the Humphrey decision, which I believe was issued in 1994.
Why not look instead at the legislative history, which indicates that this was in part modeled on legislation that was being introduced on the federal level, which had also an administrative component as well as a civil action component.
I think that is another avenue to get to the same outcome and the same decision that we are seeking from this court. Quite frankly, Justice Bradley, I haven't gotten to that in my research with the legislative history.
Butzloff talks about that. Butzloff takes you through the legislative history, I think, a little bit.
And Butzloff does talk about the legislative history, including the ability to seek punitive damages. We believe that the reasoning within Getch and Humphreys, as well as consistent with the legislative history that was just mentioned, is that there was a concern about the right to a jury trial when one seeks compensatory damages in the administrative tribunal.
Mr. Kalb, I guess my problem with your argument is this. If the legislature thought that there ought to be a jury trial, in many other situations, they've so stated. They didn't state that here. And so why should we attempt to imply something that isn't in the statutes?
I think the statutes are replete with examples where the legislature specifically states without a jury, and we cited many examples in the briefs submitted to this court where the legislature was very specific in saying in this cause of action, with this enforcement, there is no jury. We don't have that in this case. Likewise, there are statutes, we will concede, that do have the phrase with a jury. I don't think as many, but nonetheless, there is. So we're caught in a quandary of trying to understand really the intent of the legislature, which causes us to get into the statutory construction analysis. And what we have is we believe that the legislature intended that there would be a right to a jury trial in a civil damages action where one is going to seek both compensatory and punitive damages.
Could I ask you, Mr. Kalb, I was there when the Family Medical Leave Act passed. I don't remember any discussion about a jury trial. Now, that doesn't mean a thing, but But is there anything contemporaneous that you can point to refresh my recollection? I mean, is it all just kind of implicit, or was there any discussion or anything at the time that would kind of say, hey, that's really what they were thinking about?
There's nothing specific that we found in our research to indicate specifically in drafting notes or other legislative documents that would indicate that there was an intention for a jury trial.
What or an intention that there's no jury trial. It's just silent. You don't know.
Either way. And we know from Butzloff that there was a discussion at the administrative level about the rights to remedies that were being considered. We look at Rail case. We look at a number of other cases that we cited wherein there's discussion about the availability of damages and whether it's within the province of a jury to decide. Now, I tend to think that at the time when it was being discussed and negotiated and passed through the process, that there was at least someone, a group of individuals who were thinking that there would be such a right. Otherwise, why would there be a need to have a separate and different and unique enforcement mechanism solely for the Wisconsin Family Medical Leave Act? If there wasn't such an intention from our position, we believe that the same enforcement mechanism that applies to the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act and the Workers' Compensation Act would be applied to the FMLA.
Go ahead. Do you give any... Let me rephrase that. What, if any, import is there to the discussion between the drafting attorney, the written notes, and the aide to one of the sponsoring legislators when they're talking about they want to have punitive damages as available in the action, the civil action? What, if anything, do you garner from that discussion?
In reading that section of the discussion and colloquy between the two, it seemed to me that individuals who did not have a good case for punitive damages, meaning the employer did not intentionally disregard the rights of the employee, they would not be interested in pursuing a civil damages action in circuit court. That's one level of analysis I took from that discussion in Butzloff. The other import that I took from that part of Butzloff was that there was an understanding that when you would go to circuit court, there would be an entitlement to a jury trial who would decide the issues of punitive and compensatory damages.
I think that that's a reasonable inference, but I don't think it's the only inference. My best read of the legislative history is, at least it suggests, there was an intent that punitive damages, when there's an intentional violation, be available. Does that necessarily mean, however, in a civil action, be available in a civil action, not the administrative action, does that necessarily mean that punitive damages have to be tried by a jury rather than the court? Are you making a leap, or is that inherent in the concept of giving punitive damages, which apparently was part of the intent?
Number one, I think it's inherent, Justice Bradley. And number two, I think there was established Wisconsin case law at that time that indicated that the Jennings case, for one, that indicated that such issues of damages is really within the province of the jury. So when we combine those two, I think we come to the outcome where really there should be a jury trial right when there's the issues of compensatory and punitive damages in the civil action in circuit court.
Counsel, but isn't the analysis really whether the claim existed, not whether the type of damages sought existed at the time the Constitution was put in place?
I believe that that's applicable when you get to the second issue. The second issue being whether there's a constitutional right.
You're just talking about the statutory right now.
Statutory, that's correct. And I think when
well, let me just ask you a question. What kind of employee is Ms. Harbert? Is she on contract? Does she have any rights in her employment? Or can she, is she at will and can be fired for any reason?
She works at Hoffmaster. She is a member of the United Steelworkers Union. And she is subject to a collective bargaining agreement, which has many rights that afford her some protections.
All right. And I don't mean to drift into the second question. But if you say that she has various rights under the collective bargaining agreement, and therefore the employer has a limited right to terminate the employment, I would bet that the collective bargaining agreement gives rights that are guaranteed by statute to the employee.
And I don't know the answer to that question, quite honestly.
All right. Well, even if it doesn't explicitly say that, by law, an employee gets all the rights that the statutes would give them. And aren't we talking about a statutory right about retaining jobs?
That's correct.
All right. And it seems to me that you can then make the argument that implicit in the statute, which talks about rights to retain jobs, that implies a jury verdict, because generally in the law, rights like that are determined by juries, and damages for violation of employees' rights are determined by juries. Now, collective bargaining agreements, you know, are determined by the arbitration, generally by arbitration agreements, and they're not juries. But the concept generally is if an employee has rights for employment, it's usually a jury trial. So what do you have to say about that? And then I'll swing you into the constitutional argument.
With respect to the, one more point I want to make about the first issue is that there is no case deciding this very point. But when you look at the federal courts, the leading case of Frizzle, there is a great discussion that really mirrors and parallels the position that we're taking here today. With respect to the constitutional analysis.
Well, what does it say? It says if you have damages, it's jury. If you have equity, you have no jury. Isn't that what the federal cases say if you're going to sum them up?
They do.
But we haven't ever adopted that test for statutes, have we?
No.
Should we today?
Excuse me?
Should we adopt that federal test today?
Yes. Frizzle has the same issues that are presented before this court. The first issue is looking at the statute, is there an implied right? The second issue in Frizzle was there a constitutional right? And the court decided that. The Sixth Circuit decided that case on the first issue. They looked at the enforcement mechanism. They looked at the availability of legal damages as opposed to equitable damages. And the Frizzle court said that a person who files an FMLA complaint on the federal level is entitled to a jury trial when they seek legal damages.
I don't know. Maybe it did say that. But my reading, and it could be wrong, my reading of that case was that this differentiation between the equitable and the legal, the different kinds of remedies, I think they talked about in terms of the structure of the remedy, that's what they used. Then they combined that with the legislative history, and then they came to an answer. I didn't think that they came to an answer of jury entitlement based solely on the structure. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think you're absolutely correct, and I think my presentation was a little bit of a simplification of that. But they did. They looked at the structure of the enforcement mechanism, and they went into the legislative history to find out what was this enforcement mechanism modeled after, and they modeled it after the Fair Labor Standards Act, which a jury trial was an entitlement. at that time, and so based upon that, the Sixth Circuit said there is an implied right.
And they also looked at the floor debate on Congress, and there was some reference to these kinds of damages, and I think maybe even jury trial entitlement. I might be wrong on that, but they looked at the floor debate also. I'm quite confident of that. And this was in the face, again, the feds don't have any express provision for jury trial in the Family Medical Leave Act, the federal one. So this is where they found, based on the structure in the legislative history, an implied jury trial right.
That's correct.
That's what Frizzell is standing for.
In all of the cases that follow Frizzell, I think there might be six other cases that follow Frizzell. There's also a Seventh Circuit case that essentially reviewed a jury decision. They didn't specifically address the issue of the jury trial right, but by implication, they did review that and never raised any issue.
Mr. Culp, before you go on to the constitutional argument, I was just thinking about several people who have served in the legislature and then served on this court. And I remember discussions where they've indicated that oftentimes, if the legislature couldn't agree, that they would just leave it to the court. They would say nothing about it. Can't we infer that that's what happened here? The legislature really couldn't decide whether they were going to have a jury or not have a jury, so they just left it to the court.
I don't think that that's an unreasonable inference to make. I think that is an inference that can be made. And I think when you couple it with everything that that we presented to the court, I think that's the logical conclusion to reach in a civil damages action. Because we also buttress that with the public policy of the position that we're taking here today. The public policy favors the position of the appellant. It favors the position of the appellant. It goes back many years to the Federalists that talk about the need to have a jury deciding certain issues. And we know that it is a right that should be jealously guarded by the courts. We know that the courts have said, let's look at non-constitutional grounds in deciding things. It talks about that it's the bulwark of the civil liberty system. So our position that we're taking here today, and the opinion that we're seeking, the decision that we're seeking, is consistent with the public policy. Because I think in an issue in a case like this, where the administrative tribunal talked about the employer playing the game of cat and mouse with the employee who was fired and who didn't have a job for a year and a half.
Could I ask a question? What are the issues in the civil action?
The issues are not liability. The issues are purely damages. From our perspective, the issue of liability cannot be relitigated. The simple issue that should be presented to the jury is how much compensatory damages is the appellant entitled to, and how much punitive damages is the appellant entitled to.
Well, now, I like to think I'm a big advocate of jury trials. Big advocate of jury trials, but it strikes me as somewhat curious to say the jury can decide the issue of damages, but it cannot look at the question of liability. We're going to let that go to an administrative agency. Doesn't that seem unfair to you?
It doesn't. It doesn't seem unfair because of the mechanism that the legislature put before us. And it said, issues of liability are decided by the Department of Workforce Development. Issues of damages are decided by the Circuit Court. So there may be some questions about the fairness of that process, but it's a process that has been put before us, and it's a process that we as practitioners must follow. Now, on the issue of liability, it's, in our opinion, it's akin to request for admissions, where there's request for admissions that aren't answered by law under 80411, they're deemed admitted. Despite the fact that they're deemed admitted, we can present to the jury those issues and that decision and all of the issues that were before the Department of Workforce Development insofar as and limited by the decision of the administrative law judge. So from our perspective, at that jury trial, we would be presenting the decision, essentially, of what the administrative law judge, Larry Yakubowski, decided, why he decided it in the words. And it's simply limited by the four corners of the decision and order that he issued.
Why is it so important for you to have a jury trial?
We believe that the issues involved in this case are better addressed by a cross-section of the community, whether that be by six members of the community or 12 members of the community. Individuals who have experiences of all walks of life, those that have been employees, those that have been business owners, those that have been unemployed, and those that have been retired. We believe that in a deliberation room where you have 12 members that are able to bring diverse interests and diverse experiences to these issues, it's better served than having just one. Just one.
Was the plaintiff made whole for lost wages and benefits pursuant to the judge's decision?
At the administrative level, there was a make-whole remedy. Make-whole remedy in the sense of equitable damages. And the damages that she recovered are back wages.
Lost wages, benefits, interest, reimbursement for attorney's fees and costs. I'm looking at allegation paragraph 19 in your complaint. Looks like that's what was our... So help me out. What are the compensatory damages for the breach?
It's the pain and suffering that were endured during that time. An individual who had been employed since 1984 at a plant, who had been a union member, who had really experienced job security until she has a debilitating back problem.
So it's past and future pain and suffering?
Past and future pain and suffering. Punitive damages to hold the employer responsible for playing that game of cat and mouse.
Counselor, I read the administrative law judge's decision. I was trying to read it again here really quickly. You know, we have a statutory constraint on punitive damages that this court has interpreted. Did he make a specific finding that the denial of her request for, family medical leave act benefits was intentional or recklessly in disregard of her rights? I didn't see that, but maybe he did, and I was trying to look again.
We believe, and I can't pinpoint where in the decision it is, but we believe that the totality of the decision does indicate that there was an intentional violation, intentional disregard for the rights of the employee.
Do you think if you have a jury trial that you're limited to what the ALJ found, or you're allowed to bring a civil action, and you're asking for something that the ALJ never looked at, whether she had an emotional distress reaction to being out of work? Do you think you're limited to what the ALJ found, or do you think you can have more of a trial on liability? I thought I heard you say before there's no trial on liability.
We're bound by the decision on liability by the administrative law judge.
Well, that gets you into the right to make a claim, but you think you're bound further than that.
Yeah. And the issues to be decided by the jury are compensatory damages and punitive damages.
But you aren't going to get to punitive damages unless you got the requisite finding if you read our case law. Who makes the finding? That's what I was trying to get to. Who makes the finding?
The finding for purposes of recovering punitive damages, the jury. The jury decides that based upon the decision and order of the administrative law judge.
Okay, so you're asking them for liability. You're not just asking them for damages.
I think it would be the prerequisite to the punitive damages. And quite frankly, I think the judge would be the gatekeeper. I think some of the decisions by this court talks about the circuit court judge being the gatekeeper. And if the judge doesn't believe it meets the standard of intentional disregard or maliciousness, then we don't recover.
So the ALJ's finding or comments about whether it's intentional disregard of the victim's rights are irrelevant?
They're relevant.
Pardon me?
I believe they're relevant.
Why are they relevant if it's going to be a judge and jury?
The decision of the administrative law judge provides the fabric from which the circuit court will decide whether or not punitive damages goes to the jury.
I understand that, but not a legal finding of intentional disregard.
We believe that the jury would make that decision.
Yes. Well, then why do you care about what the ALJ says?
I think it provides the evidence for purposes of recovering that, to present to the jury, to show to the jury that there was an intentional disregard, for the jury to consider the actions of the employer, and for the jury to decide whether or not it's appropriate in this case to award punitive damages. The jury might say, sir, we're not entitled to punitive damages, or the jury could say something else. Notice my time's up.
Thank you, counsel. Maybe you should say something about the Constitution on rebuttal. Say, I believe in the Constitution. Murray, representing Solo Cup Company. Mr. Murray.
Please, court counsel. My name is John Murray. I represent the defendants, respondents, Solo Cup Company and Solo Cup Operating Company. We believe that if Ms. Harbat has a right to a jury trial for her FMLA claim, that that right is constitutional, not statutory. We do not believe there is any statutory right to a jury trial in this case for several reasons. First and foremost is the legislative silence. I did not find any cases where this court has read legislative silence as creating an implicit statutory right in a jury trial. The court has said on a number of occasions that when the legislature creates statutory rights, statutory obligations, that it has the authority to create an enforcement mechanism for those rights. And here the legislature did that. The legislature said that someone who believes their FMLA rights have been violated must file a complaint to the Department of Workforce Development. After cause has been determined, the Department of Workforce Development will hold a hearing in front of a hearing officer who has the right to award back pay, reinstatement, cease and desist order, and other make-whole relief, all of which were awarded to Ms. Harbaugh. If that person prevails in the administrative proceeding and any judicial appeal from that administrative proceeding, then the person has an independent right to bring a civil claim in circuit court. The purpose of that civil claim under 103.1013 is to determine what, if any, other damages were caused by the violation which the Department of Workforce Development was not authorized to address. Yes, ma'am.
I'm first going to make an editorial comment that this statutory scheme is unusual to my eye. I mean, I just don't find anything quite like it at other places. Having made that, it seems to me that my read of this statutory scheme, sub 11, sub 12, and sub 13, indicates that when in the civil action there is not a retrial of the underlying violation. Is that also your read of the statutory scheme?
Yes.
So you are in accord with your opposing counsel to that extent, that the civil action in sub 13 is an action for additional damages, if there are any.
Correct. The violation is established in the administrative tribunal, and in the subsequent civil claim, that tribunal is bound by the administrative determination of a violation, so that issue would not be relitigated. And I agree, Justice Bradley, that this is a relatively unique legislative scheme, but I think it's explainable. And I don't think it's explainable in the way Ms. Harbat has explained it. There have been concerns voiced by this court, voiced by administrative bodies, and in some legislative histories voiced by the legislature, about the divisions between the executive branch and the legislative branch. And the clearest way of making sure that the legislature does not impermissibly bestow judicial authority on the executive branch is to make sure that a claim for damages is tried in court, not the province of an administrative tribunal. By making the compensatory damages awardable only through a judicial proceeding, there is no risk that the legislature may have inadvertently or unintentionally bestowed judicial power on the Department of Workforce Development. However, those constitutional issues are separate and distinct. They deal with separation of powers. They don't deal with the necessity of a jury. The ability to recover damages is not an automatic and absolute entitlement to a jury. This court's decision 7 months ago in Rao versus WMA Security shows that. The court had an extensive discussion over the circumstances in which discovery, abuse, default judgment, judgment by default would result in not just a liability determination, but forfeiture of the right to try damages to a jury. The discussion did not address whether a jury always awards damages. It was presumed by every member of the court that a judge sitting alone may award damages. The issue that the court discussed was, under what circumstances does a party lose or waive the right to try that aspect of their case to a jury?
So who makes the determination that it's intentional disregard of the victim's rights?
Difficult question. The reality is because of the language of the statute and the determination of punitive damages, it's going to be the judge in this case who makes that determination.
The administrative law judge or the circuit court?
Circuit court, sitting without a jury.
Okay. That's your conclusion about the jury. I'm just interested in administrative law proceeding or judicial proceeding.
Judicial proceeding.
Your answer is judicial proceeding.
Yes.
The administrative law judge decides under the statute and the administrative regulations.
Yes.
Whether there's been a violation of the statute.
Yes.
And how much can be recovered?
Well, the administrative law judge...
Under limited elements.
Correct. Yes. Okay.
Then, if the victim wants to recover more than those limited elements that the administrative law judge is authorized to set forth...
Yes.
Then the victim has to go to court.
Yes.
And your position, if I understand it, is that in court, the victim has to show intentional disregard.
Intentional or reckless disregard of her rights under the FMLA. Yes.
Of the rights of the victim. And has to show the amount of damages, if any.
Correct.
Result of that. Okay. And your position is that's no jury?
Our position is if there is a right to a jury, it is a constitutional issue, not a statutory issue.
All right. All right, because the statute is silent.
Correct. Correct. Right, and, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
And the legislature knew that. The legislature was not writing on a blank slate. I mean, this court's 2002 decision in Village Food was not new. Village Food synthesized this court's 150 prior years of interpreting Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution to determine when it is necessary to find a right to a jury trial to preserve that right as it existed in 1848. And this court had previously ruled on other employment-related statutes. In 1963, in General Drivers, this court dealt with the Employment Peace Act, the Wisconsin Employment Peace Act, Chapter 111 in the current statutes. An employer demanded a jury trial under Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution for a claim alleging an unfair labor practice arising out of breach of a collective bargaining agreement. What the court, the legislature was silent. Damages were available. And what the court decided was there was no constitutional right to a jury trial because unfair labor practice litigation was not known in the common law in 1848.
Well, there was something known in the common law of 1848.
Yes.
And that was if the employee had a contract, right, with an employer, and the employer breached that contract, then the employee had a right for a breach of contract lawsuit. And breach of contract lawsuits are traditionally jury. Is there a breach and how much? Right?
Correct.
Okay. So why can't you say here, the legislature has added to the collective bargaining agreement contract provision for every employee, I'm overstating this, but for every employee in the state. The contract provision relates to medical terminations for medical reasons. And that when the employer breaches that statutorily imposed contract, then that's comparable to a very traditional, well-recognized 1848 breach of contract in employment relations.
There are several reasons why you can't say that.
Okay. First, I thought I did a pretty good job.
Sorry.
I thought I did a pretty good
standing
job.
Standing job. After we're in a plenary session, I expect all the high school students to applaud you for it.
It's not necessary. Go ahead.
Nonetheless, it's deserved if unnecessary. But the reality is, thank you, Justice Crutch, for jumping in ahead of time. There are several reasons why that argument will not establish a constitutional right to a jury trial here. And let's acknowledge that we have moved from the statutory discussion to the constitutional discussion. The first is...
I mean, I could argue that same thing, that it's implicit in the statute.
I understand
what I just said, but let's talk about
that. You have just restated and synthesized the precise argument the employer made in General Drivers, which this court rejected 45 years ago. The employer said at that point, yes, employees could sue for breach of contract. A collective bargaining agreement is a contract. This is employment related. And what the court came back with was, no, the rights here are protected by the Wisconsin Employment Peace Act. It's an unfair labor practice claim that is subsumed within, that subsumes a breach of contract claim, and it's rejected.
That's not true here. This is not part of the collective bargaining agreement.
Nor is it part of a contract. It is a statutory right.
Okay.
And in fact, it is far less contractual than the unfair labor practice claim was in General Driver, so that clearly was premised upon a breach of a collective bargaining agreement. But the more fundamental reason is that rationale departs from the rationale a majority of this court has used, the majority decisions have employed in Village Food in 2002, in Dane County versus McGrew in 2005, in State v. Schweda in 2007. This court has consistently agreed on the test to apply to determine if a constitutional right to a jury trial exists. First element of that test is, as you stated, did the claim exist? Was it known at, was it recognized at the common law in 1848 when Wisconsin's constitution was adopted? The court has not agreed, at least with sufficient similar unanimity, on how to apply that test, particularly the first element. But if you look at the majority position in those three decisions, a common theme does emerge. In each, the court set out the parameters very clearly. We do not require specific identity between the civil statutory claim and the common law claim as existed in 1848. That's why Ameritech was modified. Second, we also do not permit broad analogies, broad categories of common law claims to create a constitutional right to a jury trial to satisfy this prong. What the court did not say explicitly, but which does come out of the majority position in those three decisions, is that what needs to be common between the modern statutory action and the common law claim as it existed in 1848 is a common purpose. Both the statutory action and the common law action have to serve a similar purpose or serve the same underlying public policy. And you can see it in all three decisions.
But listen. Whether you do, I don't mean to quite like that.
That's okay.
That was my mind talking. Whether you talk about a similar purpose or you talk about a similar, you know, public policy thing, I'm not sure where that gets you. Because similar as compared to what? Is it broad? Is similar policy broad? Is similar purpose broad? I look at those decisions and I say, my, the court seems to be in disagreement.
Well, and I'm sure as someone who lived through those decisions, that
disagreement is true. On two of them,
it's true, yes, understood. That's true, but from the benefit of hindsight, when you look at just where a majority of the justices came out on the first prong of the Village Food test, I believe there is a unifying thread there that is not arbitrary.
In Village Food?
No, in all three.
Well, the first prong of the Village Food test in McGrew was that it did exist. And
the result was that it did exist, yes.
That's right. And the language of four justices was that essentially, you know, you look at it more broadly than
rule
narrowly.
Rule. Yes.
Yeah.
But if you'd like, I can explain how I see the unifying thread. Where I see is, in Village Food, the court first dealt with the Unfair Sales Act. Okay, now rather than focusing on the narrow elements of that claim, which involved violation of the regulations for setting retail pricing for gasoline, the court took a step back and said, what is the purpose of the Unfair Sales Act? And it defined that purpose as preventing predatory pricing, market manipulation by market participants in a controlled market. Then the court looked at the common law to find something common. Well, the analogy was offered to business torts, fraud, misrepresentation. The court ignored those. Instead, the court glommed onto common law torts like forestalling and regrading, because even though they didn't involve the sale of retail gasoline, those claims also served the purpose of preventing market participants from using predatory pricing to manipulate a controlled market. That same purpose analysis carried through to the McGrew case. In McGrew, the issue was whether speeding violations are triable by constitution to a jury of 12 persons. Well, obviously, as the court noted in its decision, automobiles were not mass produced until the 1890s, so there was no 1848 common law cause of action for speeding as we know it today. However, the court looked at what is the purpose of modern-day speeding regulations. That purpose is to establish rules of the road that regulate the use of public thoroughfares for the safety and convenience of the users. The court then looked at the common law causes of action that existed in 1848 and found that although speeding as it exists now did not exist, there absolutely were common law regulations which governed the use of public thoroughfares for the convenience and safety of the users. Again, it carries through to State v. Schwede. In Schwede, the court was asked whether modern environmental regulations and statutes were triable to a jury, in particular, wastewater treatment regulations. The court looked at the modern environmental regulations and said, all right, these laws exist to prevent harm in the first place and to prevent one landowner who's regulated from polluting the water system to the detriment of the public health and adjacent landowners. The only analogy which was offered, and the only analogy which was discussed at any length in the majority opinion, not in the dissenting opinion, was common law nuisance. And what the court determined at that point was, no, common law nuisance doesn't cut it, because, yes, the kind of violation we're seeing here in the environmental regs would very likely have been a common law nuisance. But common law nuisance, to paraphrase the court, covers things as broadly as disorderly conduct, excessive noise, or a cockroach baked into a pie. It is far too broad. The purpose of common law nuisance...
It's better than the pogo stick.
It comes from the decision. I don't make it up. But what became apparent was the common law nuisance in Schwede, just like The idea of fraud or misrepresentation
okay.
in Village Food.
What's the purpose here then? I suppose the purpose is what Butzloff says the purpose is. We don't have many cases that deal with 13.
Yes, we do. Because it would be far narrower than the court has suggested we should go to focus on 13. Instead, it's the purpose of the FMLA itself, and this court has decided what the purpose is. I apologize for not citing it in our brief, but in its 1992 decision, Kelly Company v. Marquardt, 172 Wisconsin 2nd, 234, this court analyzed the legislative history and structure of the Wisconsin Family Medical Leave Act, and on pages 249 and 250 stated, The legislative history of the FMLA reveals that the act was intended to assist workers in handling conflicts between the demands of their work and the needs of their families. The FMLA is designed to protect employees' jobs and benefits while on leave to care for their families or their own medical needs. The purpose of the FMLA is to balance the demands of the workplace with the demands of individuals' families. The court in Marquardt went on to explain that the FMLA is a reaction to the increasing number of women in the workplace, of single parents in the workplace, and of families in which both parents are working.
Okay, let's take a more recent case, the Butzloff case, although it's the Court of Appeals, written by Judge Bergeron. And it says, I think this is not very controversial. It says, FMLA is to be liberally construed so as to carry out its primary intent to create employee leave rights.
Correct.
Okay, if you accept that.
Well, I don't really see that as materially different from saying that it is intended to balance the competing needs of work and home. The FMLA gives finite amounts of leave for specific periods without penalty. If you exceed those finite periods, you may be penalized. If you're not eligible, if you haven't worked for at least a year, you may be penalized. I think that is simply a more simplistic paraphrase of this court's language in the Marquardt decision.
Depending on what what the facts are. I mean, if you're taking a Family Medical Leave Act to help your children or to help your mother, whatever's allowed under the statute, certainly your husband or your spouse or attend to your mother, then you come at it with a little bit, perhaps, different purpose. Here we've got a case before us where you're not talking about, under the Act, getting relief to help mom out, which I think should be constitutionally protected under all situations, or to help out other family members. But she had her own degenerative back condition, so she was there to take care of herself. And so I think that in this instance, I feel comfortable with the, as I said, I think it's not too controversial, to create employee leave rights, whether they be for the employee or whether they be for the employee's family, the employee's leave rights. I've just seen a lot of cases that existed in the that existed in the 1600s or 1700s dealing with employee leave rights. Now, the stuff that I've looked at, one of them, of course, is in the appendix, page 32, page 32 of the appendix, that are articles about, this one is the employment relation in English and American law and culture, 1350 to 1870. But there are a number of others that talk about other treatises. I have one here is, as Burns advised justices of the peace, if a servant retained for the year falls sick or is hurt or disabled by act of God of the master's business, he is not to be put away nor his wages to be abated. That might not be exact, but there are others that talk about pregnancy.
Let's deal with the example you've used. He is not to be put away or his wages to be abated. So what does that mean in terms of remedy? He's entitled to reinstatement, and he's entitled to back pay. Both equitable remedies, both available from the administrative tribunal.
Hey, could be. But listen, we're now talking, I'll get to that, but we're talking about, or I'm talking about, I thought the discussion was whether the cause of action existed.
Well,
the first prong of Village
right.
Food.
And I am moving into the second prong.
That's right. So,
and let's
assume. Say the first prong.
Let's assume you're correct on the first prong.
Okay.
You still have the issue. The two-part Village Food test is conjunctive, not disjunctive. So even if the common law claims you're citing from 16th, 17th century Britain are a sufficient common law analogy, the issue is still going to be the Article 1, Section 5 of the Wisconsin Constitution is intended to preserve the common law, the right to a jury, as it existed in Wisconsin at the time of its statehood. Don't see any legal claim for that in Wisconsin statehood. We cited in our brief Wisconsin statutes from 1838 and 1839, which involve claims that could be made by and against masters, apprentices, and servants. Those claims were triable, as we say in our brief, to justice of the peace sitting without a jury, or to municipal authorities such as mayor, alderman, or recorder. In the first set of Wisconsin statutes, 1848, 1849, Chapter 81 deals with the competing rights of masters and apprentices. Those claims are explicitly triable to probate court. At the time of Wisconsin statehood, probate court was a court of equity in which a jury did not sit. So
wrongful discharge cases, wrongful employment discharge cases, though, were tried to juries, right?
I thought we were talking about protection of leave rights.
Okay, that's right. You're absolutely correct on that. It is, as I've said before, a matter of lens, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, precisely.
It is a matter of lens.
Yes.
And if you're talking just about leave rights and what rights you have, then that may or may not be different. Now, here she was fired, wasn't she? But let me ask, given that we're not just talking about leave rights, but that she was fired for taking those 3 days, does that move you into a broader analogy for wrongful termination? And if not, why not?
Because firing someone for excessive absenteeism is not wrongful. It was not wrongful at the common law. It only became wrongful under these circumstances because of statutory rights that were created by the legislature. If you're going to analogize wrongful termination to the common law, then it has to be for comparable purposes.
One of the problems is when you're trying to mesh 1400 England with 2005 and 6 and 7, you're not going to find the...
That is correct.
Just like the rules of the road, when you can't have cars speeding if they didn't have cars.
Let's go back to leave rights then. Because if you start saying wrongful discharge, if you use wrongful discharge as the element, then I have a very difficult time understanding why claims under the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act are not triable to a jury. Why claims for OSHA whistleblowers are not triable to a jury. Why claims for any whistleblower are not triable to a jury. And the reality is they are not. The Health Care Worker Protection Statute creates rights for whistleblowers, creates a statutory cause of action for wrongful discharge. That claim is redressable only by the Department of Workforce Development, and no damages are available. If you take the funnel of wrongful discharge, that is no different than the overbroad categorizations the court rejected in Village Food when it looked at misrepresentation as a generic business tort, or when it looked at nuisance as a generic common law protection from pollution.
You get back to, I think, the statutory scheme. I mean, we're leading into the scheme. You said, you know, there's no rights under the WFEA. You're getting, now we're talking about 111.
Well, 111 is the Employment Peace Act. 103 is the FMLA.
I meant 111.
I'm sorry.
But whether it's 111 or whether it's 103, you've got a different statutory scheme.
That's absolutely
quite
correct.
Quite different, yeah.
And the key to that statutory scheme is not the remedies. The remedy is a much more critical analysis under the Seventh Amendment federal analysis, not the analysis under Article 1, Section 5 of our Constitution. Under our Constitution, the issue is, first, was the legislature silent? If the legislature was silent, it's a constitutional issue.
Why do you jump to that? Oh, I mean, we have now all sorts of circuits in this country. Let me guess, the 6th, the 8th, the 3rd, and another one that have explicitly said, look in our Federal Family Medical Leave Act. Although there is no jury trial expressly provided, we're going to find one impliedly. Right now in our Seventh Circuit, these cases are being tried. Jury instructions I have a copy of the memo that went out from the jury instructions committee. They're coming up with jury instructions on the Family and Medical Leave Act in the Seventh Circuit, at least as of the memo is now almost a year old. It was in January of 2008 when they said, these are our proper jury instructions. Please comment on them. And I just don't know the status of it a year later.
Wisconsin's Family and Medical Leave Act was based on a federal draft bill that was circulated in the 1980s.
That's right, 4,300.
It was enacted in 1986, 1987. The Federal Family Medical Leave Act wasn't enacted until 1993.
That's right, but the provisions dealing with remedy of the one in 1993 are similar to H.R. 4,300. You had, the scheme is this.
They are similar to an unacted federal bill, yes. Not to the federal statute as it exists, and not to the federal statute, which is the statute being reviewed when these federal courts determine if a jury trial exists. May I be allowed to finish my answer?
Yes.
Thank you. The Title VII of the Civil Rights Act is very similar to the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act. Since 1991, a jury trial has been available under Title VII. It's not available in the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act. The American with Disabilities Act is very similar to the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act. Jury trial available under the ADA, not in the Fair Employment Act. The substantive and procedural rights between the federal and state FMLA are even more stark than the two statutes I just mentioned in terms of amount of leave, in terms of eligibility for leave, and in terms of remedy. I can bring a claim for a federal violation of the FMLA directly in court and have a jury decide it all. In fact, only a jury decides issues of liability. The Administrative Department of Labor determination of cause carries no weight in a subsequent judicial action. None. Here, only an administrative tribunal determines issues of liability. There is...
You see that in the statute.
In which statute?
Wisconsin statute.
Where do I see what?
Where do you see it limit what can be done in the circuit court action to damages, that no question of liability can be... You both agree to that. I
don't have the language in front of me, but my recollection is, I believe it's subparagraph B, 103.10, subparagraph 13.
Yep.
It's either A or B. It talks about the issue being, can bring the civil claim to recover compensatory damages based upon the violation. The Butts Law Court of Appeals decision used that...
That's concerning the same violation.
Concerning the same violation, correct. Mm-hmm. Concerning the same violation, referencing the violation which was established in the administrative tribunal. That is the same language the Butts Law Court used to decide that only a party who has prevailed in the administrative forum and any subsequent judicial review has the right to bring this compensatory damages civil action claim in the first place.
I don't think that case dealt with whether or not you could present more in the civil action than simply the question.
No, not directly. The narrow issue in the case was whether someone who lost in the administrative tribunal
could bring a claim
for civil damages.
Correct.
But it is significant on the issue of liability because if liability were an open question which could be redetermined in the civil action, then it wouldn't matter. You get a new trial. You get a redo. If liability is an open book, then someone who prevailed in the administrative tribunal could then lose.
I'm not sure the two options are whether it's an open book or a closed book, Counselor. I think that you're asking for a different remedy that requires a different factual underpinning, and if you don't retry the suit, I don't know how you're going to get to the punitive damages that are requested, because that's based on the facts presented for the particular case.
On the issue of punitive damages, to establish the facts necessary to show intentional or reckless disregard of the violation, absolutely correct. But, now, as this court has stated a number of times, punitive damages are premised on a violation first, then a violation that is intentional or reckless disregard second. The issue of violation first is decided for the first and only time.
I don't have a problem with that. I think
I may have misspoken if I blended the two. I didn't mean to.
I just am not sure that... Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. You go ahead.
Yeah, my light's been red for some time now. Thank
All
you.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you. Our position on the issue of constitutional right mirrors exactly Chief Justice Abramson and Justice Bradley, and we have nothing to add.
Wow. This great illusion case. Hold up your file and show Mosher tends to go home.
There are seven.
That's right. There were seven of them last time. Do you know how to count to four, Counselor?
With a little more seriousness, the it is, from a practitioner's perspective, difficult to apply the village foods test. We concede that. And I think it's difficult for the court in looking at the various opinions that have arisen from Ameritech, Village Food, McGrew, and Shreda. We know that the Ameritech test set, does it codify? Does the present cause of action codify it? Village Food said, that's too narrow. Of course, we addressed the two prongs of the Village Food test, and we know that it is at least currently the current test. It's easy to state, but difficult to apply, because in these decisions in 2002 in Village Foods, we see references to comparing whether or not the present cause of action is of the same nature. And that's the phrase that's used, to what common law actions existed at the time the Constitution was adopted in 1848. Another phrase that is used in Village Foods is whether or not it's a forerunner of the modern statutes. And then we advanced three more years, and McGrew has decided, and McGrew argued for a broad application of the Village Food Test. The county argued that there should be a narrow meaning. And again, the phrases of the same nature appeared. We know from McGrew that specific identity isn't required, but all of a sudden there's references to it being differing slightly, essential counterparts. We also know that, at least in part of the majority, there was reference to that the lead opinion should broaden its lenses when it looks at and applies the Village Foods Test. And of course, in the end, in McGrew, that seems to be exactly what happened. So Village Food broadened Ameritech test, and McGrew applied it in a broad fashion in the sense that speeding was compared to the general rules of the road at that time. And of course, as was mentioned, cars were not invented at that time, so there was a broad application. Now, Shreda recognized that McGrew gave that expansive interpretation, but then it started using words about it cannot have just merely doctrinal roots, insufficient, a mere resemblance of the two causes of actions are insufficient. But when I read Shreda and read it over and over and over and tried to understand exactly why the decision was rendered, it seemed to me that the court was grappling a bit with the sprawling concept of really what nuisance is. And if you apply this broad concept of nuisance to environmental regulations, it nullifies the Village Foods Test. We don't have that very situation here. We know at least one justice in Shreda said, our inquiry focuses on whether the statutory causes of action in this case are of a similar nature. So it seems that the common thread between the three cases is whether or not the present cause of action is of a similar nature.
But that doesn't that beg the question, what do you mean by a similar nature? In Village Food, you're comparing a criminal action with forestalling contract or something. I mean, it might be similar, it might not be.
I think the discussion in Village Food with respect to that comparison of the criminal law to the civil law illustrates that there is and should be a broad application of it. Specific identity isn't required and shouldn't be necessary. Now, in this case, in the Wisconsin law, we seem to trace the roots of the Wisconsin Family Medical Leave Act in various parts of history. In 103.10 in the 80s, there's reference to what that statute really meant. And we go back to 1911, and it talks about minimum work age for minors, education for minors in the workplace. We go to 1849, and it talks about protecting apprentices from cruelty by masters. I know my time's up, but if I may finish.
You may finish the sentence quickly.
I think in sum, believe that when you look at the second part of the test, decisions focus on the nature of the release sought in the present case. When we couple the discussion we had of the first element and the second element, we come to the conclusion that there is a constitutional right to a jury trial and a civil damages action under the FMLA. But we don't believe we get to that because we believe there's an implied right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Pope, and thank you, Mr. Murray, for your excellent arguments on an issue the court has faced previously, namely when is a plaintiff entitled to a jury trial. And we appreciate your arguments and your briefs. That concludes our hearing in 07-AP-1396, Kelly J. Harbert versus Solo Cup Company. Can our students from Green Lake High School stay for a few minutes, or are they meeting a bus or other transportation? Who's in charge? Well, we appreciate your coming. You may watch for this opinion several weeks or months on the court's website and view other educational materials on the court website. Thank you very much. You know what the court's website is? Good. Thank you. We are in recess till tomorrow morning.